So we have Josh Dahlke in the studio here, kind of. Josh, you know, I was reading online, I think, you had posted something about your family land in Minnesota. And it's been in the family for how many years?
Oh, man, I don't know the exact count. I should probably come up with that one of these days, but somewhere around probably 130 years.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Wow. So would that be like your, what, great-great-grandparents or...
Right, yeah, they came over here from Sweden, and they left a rock-infested country that was difficult to grow stuff, and they came to a rock-infested country that was maybe even colder and difficult to grow stuff.
That is amazing. I'm living in a 130-year-old farmhouse, by the way, in rock country, so I consider myself a rock farmer. But I know that you had a pretty memorable hunt there last fall. Take us into that one first.
Yeah, so even though I've been deer hunting for a long time, I'm sure a lot of your listeners can identify that, you know, there haven't been more than a couple opportunities in my life where I've actually been able to hunt a deer that I had some kind of history with. That just hasn't been my reality. And that's even with running some heavy trail cameras and stuff like that. Most of the deer I've hunted or ended up shooting, you know, it was more based on like a general pattern, and a buck, you know, that I want to shoot walks in at some point and I shoot it. But this was a different scenario for me in that I did actually have some trail camera images of this deer from the previous year at a few different locations. From what I could tell, it seemed like he was only calling our farm his core for a certain part of the year. Which I did later come to find out was true, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I had images of this deer. He was a great deer. We never saw him in person at all, never even got a look at him in 2022. And started running cameras again summer of 2023. He rolled in. I think first image I got of him was... And maybe in October, I think it was when I was on an antelope hunt during October, I was driving out to Wyoming, and I got a picture of him, and I was like, wow, he's actually back. He survived, which is a tall order in a lot of parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin, whether it be hunting or car collisions. A lot of deer get hit on the road by our farm. And then the winter that we had in 2022 was one of the worst on record. We lost a lot of deer. To put it in perspective, I did a late season muzzleloader hunt in December, late December of 2022, and we counted, I think it was 23 yearlings on one of our fields, and only two does, which I still don't understand how that worked. But we were going out there trying to do some doe patrol with me and three of my buddies, and we saw what we could identify at least as 23 yearlings that were out there. So we didn't end up even shooting a deer that night.
Wow.
Well, between us and our neighbors, we found somewhere between 20 to 25 yearlings that died that we found in the spring of 2023. So we lost a lot of deer. So it was pretty miraculous to see that buck made it through, showed back up, and he was super regular. So I kind of had him pinned on what his core was. And I mean, like within a 200-yard radius of where he was spending most of his time. And that was just all through running cell cams. And thankfully, I had deployed the one key camera we put on a community scrape during turkey season in the spring of 2023. And luckily... I put lithium ion batteries in it, and it ran all the way up until it didn't die until I think like sometime in late October, early November. So I was able to go in and hunt them for the first time and then switch the batteries. But moral of the story was we put that camera out on that community scrape during turkey season, and that was right in the bullseye of his core. So the fact that we didn't have to go back in there at all, and we could just let him do his thing and then go in strategically was a huge part of it. So he was showing up on some other cameras, and I take a pretty conservative approach Like I said, this is the first, really the first deer I've been able to hunt where I had history with. I mean, I've hunted somewhere. I've maybe been at a friend's or an outfitter's or something where they knew the deer. But on a personal level, this was my first time to go after a deer that was on one of our properties. And so, regardless of whether it's that or just deer hunting in general, I'm pretty conservative and I usually kind of start from the outside and work my way in. And so that's what I was doing with this buck. Because he was showing up once in a while on some other cameras, but it was usually at night. And I figured, well, maybe with the rut kicking in and things changing a little bit, maybe I'll catch him daylighting. I didn't. I hunted the fringe and I waited for the right wind to get in there and try to hunt him where I knew he was, because he was hitting that community scrape a dangerous amount for his survival. And we had also set a stand on that community scrape during that spring turkey season as well. So I went in there to hunt him for the first time in late October, kind of pre-rut. And sure enough, I saw him coming in, coming back in the morning. And I just caught one little glimpse of him, and he didn't come in and hit that scrape. He was hitting that scrape every single day at that
Wow.
point. Whether it was morning or evening, he was daylighting a bunch and hitting that scrape. And that morning, even though I had the wind right, he didn't come into that damn scrape. So I watched him go into this thicket only about 100, 150 yards from me, and I was pretty sure that he was bedding in there. And it was one of those spots where I'm in some pretty core bedding. And so I got in there real early, in the middle of the day, and I was on edge the whole time. And you don't know which way to look because there's deer coming from everywhere. It's one of those I kind of had to roll the dice knowing that I'd probably have some deer downwind of me, which did end up happening. So I thought I had some deer blow at me pretty early in the day. I thought maybe they probably blew it for me, literally. And I happened to be looking forward toward the scrape instead of behind me. And I heard a little bit of commotion behind me, and I looked back there. And sure enough, he had circled downwind and busted me, and I caught another glimpse of him, and he was running back into his bedding.
This was the
And
same day that the first time you saw him?
the same day.
Okay.
Same day, yeah, I was out there for, I think I sat for like 6 or 7 hours. And no, wait. I sat longer than that because it was an all-day sit. I got in there in the dark. I caught him coming back in the morning. And then I had a bunch of deer moving around throughout the morning and middle of the day. I had some deer downwind that blew at me, and we were all within 100, 150 yards of each other. So he definitely heard those deer blow. My theory is that he had heard those deer blow earlier in the day, and instead of coming in to hit that scrape like he had been doing every other day, he scent checked it instead because he heard them. He's probably laying there and he's like, "All right, well, I'm gonna get up. Go hit that scrape like I do every day, but I am not going to go march right into it." I think that, I mean, who knows what he was thinking, but sure enough, he busted me. And of course, I was distraught. I thought I would never see him again and this and that. And I was so nerve-wracked sitting on that scrape because I was in bow range of it. Minnesota, last year, you were able to start using crossbows. And I love hunting with crossbows. So I was using a crossbow. That was an ideal spot for a crossbow because maybe you could get away with drawing, but I was only 20 yards from this community scrape and there was deer everywhere. So not having to have that extra movement would be a huge benefit. So I decided after that whole rigmarole with that, shotgun season was going to open in about a week, 10 days. And I'm not a dedicated bow hunter by any means. I just love to deer hunt. I'll use a compound, I'll use a crossbow, I'll use a muzzleloader, a slug gun, a rifle, but I really like gunpowder. So I decided I was going to just do all day sits when gun season opened and just try to maximize my opportunity to have an encounter with them. And I was going to hunt the downwind side of that community scrape with my shotgun, so that I was still in range of it. But the only way that he'd be able to get downwind of me, if he was going to come scent check it again, he'd basically have to go walk onto the road because this is right along a road. So I figured if I could get far enough over and high enough and do a hanging hunt that I'd be able to probably get a shot if he came and hit that scrape again at some point. Well, the wind conditions switched so that it wasn't going to allow me to do that setup that I had envisioned. And so I was actually camping out there, and I sat in bed the night before shotgun opener, just looking at hunt stand and looking at all the wind conditions. And I knew that I couldn't. It's one of those things where you want to convince yourself, oh, I can get away with it, but I knew better, so I wasn't going to push it. But in order to pivot and have a different setup, I knew I was going to have to do a hanging hunt somewhere else. And I wasn't really looking forward to doing that. So, and actually, I'm going to backtrack a second. I told you I was originally going to hanging hunt that spot by the road. I was actually going to hunt from the ground because I thought I had enough elevation to be able to see that scrape and be less impact, not having to go in there and hang a stand. And so I was just going to stand by a tree all day. And when I woke up that morning, I was like, I have to do a hanging hunt. And I knew where I needed to do it, where the wind was a little bit better, a spot I could slip in from the road on this kind of open pond area that wasn't in sight of the scrape. But there was a peninsula that led to the scrape that I knew he had just been in that general area. So I got up that morning. I had some hawk climbing sticks that weren't even assembled yet. They're still in the box. So I woke up extra early. I put the damn sticks together. I hauled everything out there. I hiked in from the road. I hung this stand on this pond. There was deer sign everywhere in there. The wind was perfect for me. And ended up seeing a bunch of deer that morning, a bunch of bucks that any other year I normally would have shot. And sure enough, right when I was kind of just letting my guard down a little bit later in the morning, the neighbors were blasting off. All I'm thinking is someone shot him. I was getting ready to text one of the neighbors to see if maybe he had shot him. But I was keeping this tight to my vest, so I didn't think anybody else... I shouldn't say I didn't think anybody knew about this deer, but I wasn't communicating with anybody about it. Let's put it that way. So all of a sudden I looked up and he was standing there. I had about 60, 65 yards. And it was one of those encounters where I took a second to just admire the deer, because it was just such an amazing animal that, like, I looked up and I was in disbelief that he was standing there, and I just took a second to admire him. And then he started walking and he was going to go into this thicket, and I kind of had to snap myself out of it. I was like, what the hell are you doing? Stop looking and shoot. So, and I was trying to self film. So I raised up on him and I'm like, no, get the camera on him. I go to move my camera. It's on a ball head.
Yep.
And it was tightened. I thought it was tightened to just the right tension where I'd be able to adjust the camera with one hand and it would stay. Well, I went and I adjusted it, and it had loosened just enough that when I let go, the camera just went and tipped over and the lens hit the camera arm.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like, forget the footage. And I pulled up and shot him. It was with a 20 gauge slug gun with it was probably like some kind of federal copper bullet, I believe it was. And he only went 20 yards. And
oh my gosh. Now, how old were you? You said you saw this deer like in 22 for the first time you knew he was there. So what was he then, like 3-year-old, or was he older than that?
Yeah, I think in 22 he was a 4 or a 5-year-old in 2022. And then I shot him in 23. So he was either 5 or 6.
Dang.
And the reason I can confidently say that, this is the crazier twist of the whole story. So, small town, my great uncle, he's like 86 years old. He lives up there. And I went and got him, and we did the whole recovery together. My brother and his girlfriend showed up, and we made a whole deal of it just to spend some time together and enjoy the deer. And we decided we were going to go into town to the gas station to weigh him, because they had a weigh station there. Mm-hmm. So we roll into town. We weigh the deer. He wasn't actually that heavy body weight-wise. I thought he'd be bigger, but I think he lost a bunch of weight in the couple weeks leading up to shotgun season. And so I don't remember what his dress weight was. It was nothing super impressive, but the kid at the check station was like, "Oh, do you want to enter into our big buck contest?" I'm like, "I guess. What does it entail?" And you know, it's all based on body weight, so they have different classification or different like tiers, I guess. And he's like, "Yeah, I'll just take a picture and we'll take the weight and you'll go on the board and here's the categories." I'm like, "Okay, well, I'm not gonna win, but whatever, sure." So puts my picture on the board. I end up going back up there for muzzleloader season. And at that point, there's probably 50, 60 pictures on this board, a bunch of nice deer. It's kind of cool checking it out. Well, then I get to, I believe I was in Oklahoma in late December. And I get this Facebook message through Facebook Messenger from this guy. And he says, "Word on the street is you got a nice buck by, I'm not going to say where it is, but so-and-so city." And I'm just like, "You got to be kidding me." Like, I keep a pretty low profile in that area. I mean, I'm friendly with people and stuff, but, you know, I just kind of do my thing. And my response to him was, "It depends who's asking." And he's like, "Well, I'm pretty sure we have the property that is kitty corner from you guys to the southeast. And I know exactly what property it is because there's a corn food plot on there every year sponsored by the NWTF that they leave up all year. And all of our deer from our woods are patterned on that food plot. They go there every single night. So it's just a matter of whether I can catch them during daylight, which is not often, but every night they cut through our woods and then they cross the road and they go into that food plot." And so we end up talking, end up kind of hitting it off, just messaging each other. And we agree to kind of trade some information, trade some photos and stuff. And I'm like, "How did you find me?" He's like, "Well, I was in at the gas station and I was looking at the photo board and I saw the buck and I recognized it."
Oh my gosh. I'm like,
"Okay, that's crazy enough in itself. How did you find me?" Well, he just did some digging around and we happened to have a friend of a friend and connected on Facebook somehow, and he found me and he put two and two together. And the kicker of the whole story is he tells me that he's got this history with this deer. He's been going after him. And so I felt a little bit bad because he had been after this deer for like, I think 3 years.
Oh, wow. That
he had made a, like he had identified him and he was letting him go. And, but here's the thing, the deer was only living over on his property after season and then into early summer. And then he would come over to ours for the rest of the year and he would never daylight on that guy's property. He'd go into that corn food plot every night and then he'd come back to ours in the dark.
Wow.
We're talking literally distance from his core bedding to that food plot is probably only about 600-700 yards maybe. So this deer was living most of his life, I think, within, let's just say, 1,000-yard radius.
Yep.
He had everything he needed. And I'm pretty sure that's what he was doing. He might have ventured out at some point. Maybe he did. But between our information that we put together, I think he was really keeping it tight. So the coolest part about this story to me is the guy said, "I've got his match sheds from the past 2 years." And he said, "I want you to have the sheds. They belong with the deer."
Wow.
And I was like... I sat there for a few minutes and then I responded to him and I said, "Dude, this isn't my deer. I just happened to be the one who was lucky enough to shoot it. Put some more thought into this. I do not have any expectation that you would give me those sheds. Those are your sheds. You have a history with this deer even more than I did. And you know, don't feel compelled to give me those sheds." He's like, "I just want to," he's like, "I'm assuming you're getting it mounted. So I just want to see it when it's mounted. So swing by my house sometime when you're on your way up to the farm. I want to see the deer and I'll give you the sheds because they belong with him."
My gosh, what a story. That is amazing.
Pretty cool.
Number one, that you, I mean, you did have a good history with him, and you did, you outsmarted him. But for that guy to do that, it's pretty cool. Now, I have to ask, are you originally from Minnesota?
I am, yeah. I grew up in South St. Paul, and okay. that farm is in central Minnesota.
Okay, so what I want to tell you guys something about Josh that I've learned, not just about Josh, about where he's from, Minnesota. Some of the best hunters I've ever met have been, and I don't know why this is, northern Minnesota, Maine, Vermont, Michigan. If you listen to that story, which took 20 minutes, so many things that Josh talks about, and I know Josh is much younger than I am, are things that guys like Greg Miller did back in the 70s and the 80s, John Eberhardt, the tactics that he used. Granted, he has modern technology on his side now, and I'm not going to get into that because I think it's a tool. You used remote cameras. Back in the day, you kind of were guessing. That's kind of how I learned. You kind of guessed, but we could not pinpoint it like you did. But over the years of all that experience, exactly what you talked about, especially on smaller properties of these mostly what we say Midwest, but it's mostly upper Midwest, northern places, even in some places of Illinois and Iowa. But those bucks learn as they get older how they can survive. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen a situation like that where you have this buck that's 4 or 5 years old, or sometimes even six, which is almost unbelievable when you bring in the hunting pressure. And then, like, Minnesota, he's talking about the winters. That winter was like one of the ages, killed a lot of deer.
Yes.
But how they can hone that in, and he's talking about a core area, which is different than the home range, obviously, of a, what, 700 acres, or not even 700 yards. You're talking maybe a couple hundred acres of his core yes, range.
Absolutely. Yep.
And you figure that out, but, you know, what, maybe one other guy knew about that deer? Maybe he told his buddies, but not too many. It wasn't like a suburban deer where it's like, yeah, everybody knows that deer by Fleet Farm because he can't get hunted. But you have a deer like this. I just find it fascinating. Deer Talk Now is brought to you by Wildlife Research Center and the new Golden Rope Scent Rope Kit. The kit comes with 4 ounces of Golden Rope Scent Concentrate, 3 cable ties, and 3 scent ropes made of proprietary fibers meant to absorb the maximum amount of scent. Simply saturate the rope in your scent of choice, hang it from a branch, and watch the trail cam photos come flying in. For more information, go to wildlife.com. One question I do want to ask you, and this has nothing to do with product, I'm just curious. What kind of cameras do you run normally?
So I run stealth cams and muddies. They both run through the same app, the Command Pro app, which is convenient, so I don't have to use multiple apps. It depends on what I'm trying to do. But usually I'll run them just in photo mode with like a 3 second delay, a 2 photo burst, just to try to get the information I need without digging too deep into the battery life. That's for deer, but for turkeys, I do a bunch of different things, which we can get to in a little bit.
That's what here. I do want to pick your brain on that because I know you've got some tactics for that. But, and you said you're using those lithium batteries also?
Yes. Lithium ion. Man, I know they're expensive, but it's so worth it. And I'll tell you, I've had very good, there's thing about lithium ion batteries is there's only like 2 or 3 brands you can get. You got Energizers, and then there's like 2 brands on Amazon. And one of them, I think they're called like Bevagor or something. They're a gray body with red writing on them. Per battery, they're the least expensive lithium ions you can get. You should order them in bulk. They sell them in like 72 packs or 100 plus packs. It's a lot to stomach when you make that purchase because they're very expensive, but You absolutely make up for it in the back
Well, you
end.
said you went from what, turkey season all the way to October
Oh, yeah.
on one set of batteries.
Yeah, and that was with a lot of traffic. I mean, there were deer on that camera every single day, multiple times a day. And I was running it daylight and dark, 24 hours a day. So you can get a lot, but also, man, I've been testing the solar this spring and been having really good luck with that too.
Yeah.
Those solar panels actually can do, they're pretty
I'm
magical.
impressed. I'm running that those on the cuttybacks, and I have had that camera out all winter. And granted, we haven't had a terrible winter, but it's sending me pictures every day. That is really
Thank you.
cool. Let's switch quickly over to turkeys, Josh. I would love to talk to you all day, and we're going to probably have to get Josh back for another one of these, Ian. But right now, you're getting. I know you're eating. The other thing I want to say, Josh, is you and I have known each other through the industry, but the more I talk to you today, I learned like Jake was right. Like you're a hell of a lot like me because like I would have done the same thing. I'm like, I don't care if I kill this deer with a bow or a crossbow or a shotgun. And I am going to, the other thing, Dave Larson would have done what you said you were going to do, go stand by a tree. Most people would say, oh, you can't do that. Like, yeah, you can. You have to have, be that eternal optimist. But
Absolutely, man.
switching to turkeys, and I know I use the Hunt Stand app a lot. I know you use it for turkey season, but give us some insight as to people say, well, what do you need to scope for turkeys for? Like, how hard is it? Well, if you turkey hunt long enough, you're going to figure this out.
Well, Dan, you're gonna have to. You're opening up Pandora's box. I'm obsessed with turkey hunting. I have been since I started when I was about 15 or 16 years old, and I got it bad. So you're gonna have to probably cut me off and limit me at times, or otherwise we could be here for a
You
week.
got about 10 minutes, so
Oh boy. Well, 10 minutes? Okay. Well, go find one and shoot it, I guess. I don't know.
no, that you know, we know you got better tips than that.
So,
How do you scout? Because I know you're a lot like me. Well, when I used to be as eaten up with it as you probably still are, you have to have several aces up your sleeve. You have to. You just simply have to. You have to have those bonus spots. You can't just have your one access spot and say, "Oh, that's where I'm going to turkey hunt for 4 weeks or whatever." However long you can get hunt in your state. How do you approach it?
I'm really happy you just said that because that is the most important thing for consistently killing turkeys. All right. If you got one tag and you're only going to go hunt once a year or whatever, that's a whole different thing. But if you're trying to consistently kill them through the entire season, which I hunt all over the country, but in the Midwest here, the season for me is generally early to mid-April till June 1st. And I hunt all the way to the bitter end. I always hunt the last day of May by myself until the season closes on that day. Even if it's thunderstorming, even if that just means sitting in my truck, grinding it out, watching turkeys, I will be there until the last minute of the season. But what you just said is the most important thing for consistently killing turkeys, and that's having A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I. You can't have an A, just an A spot. You can't just have a B spot and a C spot. The more you can have, the better, because as the season goes on, the patterns are going to shift and the dynamics are constantly shifting. And so you're going to have birds moving around and you're going to have birds coming into different areas that they weren't before. And you're going to have birds just coming and going. And so you might get excited, 2 weeks leading up to when your season opens. And then, you got pictures or you're out there scouting and you see birds and then all of a sudden you go out there and they're not there on the one weekend you might have to hunt or whatever it is. Well, you need somewhere else to go. And then if that doesn't pan out, you need somewhere else to go after that. And, maybe they're going to be there in the morning and not in the evening. So maybe you need two different spots for just for hunting one day. Giving yourself those options is the most important. So for me, and there's still a part of me that's really hesitant to shed a lot of light on this, but I am a big door knocker. Don't get me wrong, I'll hunt public land, but if I don't have to, I won't
Right.
because I like to hunt unpressured turkeys and I'm not afraid to knock on anybody's door. And I still haven't had a gun pulled on me. I know. I did have a guy with a shotgun behind his door one time in Montana when I was antelope hunting, but he didn't grab it, so that was nice. But I did see
Jeez.
that it was there.
Wow.
But I have really good luck door knocking, and I can actually pull up Hunt Stand right now and just give you a quick like snapshot of just one area that I hunt. I won't say where it is, but this will give you an idea just by taking a glance at this of the permission properties that me and my crew of guys work with throughout the season, just in one area.
Oh my gosh, look at that. So
So
all those pins are places where you can go.
most of them are places we can go. Some of them are, I mark all the spots that are no's as well. I have everything color coded. I
Oh,
have
okay.
assistance to it so that when we're driving around, we can just bounce from one property to another. And the big thing with me is Wisconsin, for instance. You know how the system works there. A lot of your listeners probably know how the system works there. It's all based on a quota system. It's still a draw, but then there's always surplus tags left over for certain zones. And you can buy surplus tags when they're available. You can buy one per day until they're sold out. So theoretically, you could go into the last day of the turkey season with 20 tags in your pocket.
Yep.
I buy one tag for myself for each season for DE and F, because as a non-resident where I hunt, earliest I can't get A, B, or C. I
Right.
can only get D, E, and F. So I buy one tag for each of those seasons. So I always have a tag in my pocket for each season. But then the rest of the time, I spend 80% of my turkey season scouting and for other people and bringing other people.
That's pretty cool.
Friends who don't have as much time as I do, I'm still single. I don't have kids. So
That's what people, their first question is, like, what does this guy do that he gets off for the whole turkey season?
well, I don't. I still have to work, but mornings and evenings, I'm going to be out there.
You're like Brian Lovett because you're going nonstop.
Brian is Brian is the same way.
You got to be insane to do it because I can't even say I've tried to keep up with him, but it's like that is how just. If you haven't done it, and I hesitate saying it because I don't want to give away my spots, but let me just back up. When you were talking about, okay, I don't have the charisma that you do to knock on doors and get permission as much. Mine was always public land. But what I always did was I'd have my one or two spots that are on private, and then those public lands, one was always good at like 9 o'clock. Everybody was out of there. They were up there for the roost. They were listening to turkeys gobble. Turkeys all went and went from 9 to noon. You could kill a turkey, and you
Absolutely.
basically just had to adopt that mentality. Some when we finally, this was quite a few years ago, when we finally could start hunting in the afternoons, some people wouldn't even touch them, and then you're like, there's that one spot that those one thing that Josh said, those turkeys come and go, especially as the season goes on, and then some of them were like. When you're talking about E and F, those last 2 weeks, you wouldn't see a turkey out there for the first 4 weeks. And then those last 2 weeks w was lit up. But one thing that you mentioned on that app is what I really like about that. And not to be that guy, but I use it to find out if I know there's a really prime piece of private ground next to public ground. I guarantee you, I'm using Hunt Stand to find out where their property line is because if you set up and you sit there long enough, you're going to have people say, "Well, I don't own land." You don't have to own land. You just have to know how to. You have to know how to walk, and you have to know how to be patient, which I have no patience. But like once you get back in there and you know there's turkeys in there, if you want to fill a tag, you can do that. And that is what's different today than what used to be. What used to be, people just did not know how to hunt. I think a lot of people know how to hunt now, and people know how to call. They're listening to guys on YouTube and Instagram and TikTok and all these videos. It's like we're teaching people how to hunt. It's just learning the next part of it, I think, is the big hurdle for most guys. Just to add on to that, I have to be able to brag about this because it's the only time I'm ever able to do it. I killed 5 out of 6 periods 2 years ago. I got first.
That's awesome, man.
First, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. And then everybody was accusing me as like, yeah, where's your bait pile? I'm like, nope, can't do that. You just got to be crazy enough to want to go out there and kill them. But it was throughout the middle of the day, some in the morning. It's kind of that same hopscotch mentality. But that's I don't so quite cool. have it as you do as far as that network. I mean, if you have a network like that, that extends your spring for turkey hunting. But my gosh, you really must also be learning how to deer hunt those same places if you have access to them.
Oh man, yeah, the amount of deer scouting you can do while you're out there turkey hunting. But it's funny because you got to flip your switch. You know, like if you're out there turkey hunting, you're not necessarily opening yourself up to the observations that you need to get deer intel. You really got to tap into your consciousness and force yourself to take a deeper look. Cause you know, the way that you walk through the woods for different reasons and different intentions, your focus shifts dramatically. Shed hunting is a great example. I'm the worst shed hunter on earth, but if you're not looking for sheds, yeah, you'll stumble into them now and then, but like, imagine how many you walk by when you're not looking at the ground. I mean, when I'm turkey hunting, I look at the ground, look for scratchings and tracks and stuff, but most of the time I'm trying to look way ahead, you know, see if I can catch any movement, or just, I'm always thinking about my next move. So, but then, you know.
And trying to learn the terrain too on some of those properties where there could be a natural barrier that you didn't know about, like a fence line or a creek or, you know, something like that. You got a turkey gobbling and, I know what you mean. You're like trying to project, like, okay, that turkey's over there. What's standing between me and him right now? And it's almost like you're playing army when you're a kid. Like, how do I get to him without him knowing I'm over here?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing, man, is getting to him. And any little bit of terrain or cover that you can use to your advantage, you're right. Like, and that shifts throughout the year as well, you know. When the season opens in mid-April, when I can start hunting in Minnesota, there's like zero leaf cover. And then by the time you get to mid-May, it's a jungle. So you kind of learn those little nuances too. You know what you can get away with at different times of the year. And once you sort of figure out kind of what their overall patterns are, because their patterns are crazy repeatable, like year to year.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sure they pass that down through just learning. And also through a deeper level in genetics, I think a lot of that behavior is passed on. So it's no coincidence that you see them in the same spots. A lot of it's probably food source driven too. You know, they're shifting their patterns with available food sources and whatnot. But yeah, just being able to hunt all season on a lot of these places and understand those seasonal shifts is really important. You got to pay attention to those details, and that comes back to the consistency, killing them consistently as well. Like, yeah, if you got a bunch of properties and you go out and hunt them for one season, you probably do all right. But to be able to repeat that year after year, you're constantly just taking in that knowledge, and so you get more granular and you get more focused on your strategy, because all those little nuances of shifting foliage, shifting food sources, and shifting how the flock dynamics work and stuff. And when gobblers start to venture out, you kind of figure out like, okay, this spot is useless, even though it looks like an A spot. I know that it doesn't get good till the third week of May. And then you go back there year after year, and it's like, oh, there's a strutter third week of May. Like, it can be shockingly like clockwork. And if you pay attention to that stuff, and the thing about it is, man, it's hard to keep all that straight in your head and file that away. So once again, this as a tool, using Hunt Stand, you know, I mark all my observations with date and time and what's going on with the turkey. Is it a single strutter? Is it a group of jakes? Is it a strutter with hens? Like, because all those little flock dynamics make a difference too. Because, you know, like, for instance, if you go to a spot and you see there are a bunch of hens at some point, you know whether there's a gobbler there at that time or not. There is going to be. period. Like, probably in short order. If you see hens, there's going to be a gobbler there probably even that day. Or if not, it's going to be the next day. But those hens are not going to be by themselves when they're still breeding.
Not for long, anyways.
No.
That's a good point there as far as, okay, somebody might be listening to this and say, oh, yeah, must be nice to have 20 different spots to hunt. Or, you know, I don't have time to knock on that many doors. Well, here's the thing. If you pick up on what Josh just said, let's say you're only hunting your one spot, your 40 acres, your 20 acres, whatever. If you take that intel that Josh is talking about and say, maybe for whatever reason, the third week of the season is when you see those toms normally. If you take inventory of that data, you know what I'm saying? Then you start planning. It's like, you know what? I'm not going to apply for first period, you know, or I'm not going to put all my energy or my vacation days into hunting the first period. So that's one thing. The other thing, excuse me, is knowing the terrain is the biggest thing, and knowing where those hens are, and then just adapting that that patience mentality. Is it going to pay out every time? No. But it's really going to help you out. So on that, I actually have to cut you off. But, Josh, I know you do a lot of different things. You do work with Hunt Stand. You do work with GSM. Tell the listeners, you know, some of the things that you have been working on and some of the things maybe product-wise that you find pretty exciting for this year.
Oh, man, yeah, there are several things. Hunt Stand is going through a big revamp right now that people can look forward to coming out this summer, so you'll have enough time to get used to it before fall deer seasons. And we're not gonna drop it right during the middle of turkey season either. So it's gonna be a whole overhaul, like, of the user interface. We're gonna also be adding some new tools to that I can't really talk about right now. But people can look forward to a refreshed Hunt Stand, which is going to be really nice. I'm testing the beta version right now, so I've already got some experience with that. And then, man, some of the other stuff I've been working on. We own GSM owns walkers, so we've got some pretty exciting new products for walkers. The Recon Muff, which is kind of an upgraded version of the Razor electronic muff that so many people have. I think just about everybody I know has a Razor. The Recon is kind of the next generation of that, a little bit higher quality, but still not that expensive. And then the most profound product that we've got coming out under the GSM brands is with Stealth Cam, and that is our Revolver cellular trail camera. It's a 360-degree cellular trail camera. It has 6 PIR detection zones surrounding the camera with a rotating lens. So when one zone is triggered, the lens shifts over, snaps that image, and then you can program it so it'll snap all the other PIR zones 360 immediately. So you're not just getting that one snapshot of what's going on of a deer walking in front of the camera. You're finding out what else is going on around
there. That's pretty cool. So you could have the doe here and you could have the buck behind you. So that's pretty cool.
So, or how many times do you put a trail camera on a tree where you think it's the right trail and that buck is walking behind that camera all year?
Always. That always happens. And yeah. I think they learn it. I think they actually learn it if they know those cameras are there. Well, you guys, yeah. I know that's just a brief snapshot. Check that stuff out. Josh, thank you so much for joining us. Like I said, we're going to have to do this again because we could talk for hours on this, not just about scouting, but deer and turkeys. And yeah, good luck. And I plan on seeing lots of dead turkey pictures on your Facebook page.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Josh Dahlke. For Josh Dahlke, I'm Dan Schmidt. Thank you for joining us for Deer Talk Now. We are how many away, Ian? One away from our 100th episode? Or we're probably already past it. We're past it. We're going to put that in the comments for you because we have a pretty good user-generated question one on that. But for Josh, I'm Dan. We'll catch you again next Thursday for another episode. And just check out these podcasts wherever you can find a podcast or watch the video versions on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, etc. We'll catch you next week for another episode of Deer Talk Now.